Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thanks again, Audrey, for getting us started on the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I almost forgot the name of it tonight, and then I started looking around some of the news. I do that all week to get ready for the show. And Justice is a little jumbled based on Ferguson and Staten Island, New York. But we won't talk about those directly tonight, but we'll be very closely hanging around the edge of that, as our presentation tonight is about video camming the police, and also police complaints, public complaints against the police, that type of thing. And we're going to have a panel from the Cato Institute, their annual luncheon, or not annual, but their weekly luncheon presentation. It's about an hour and 20 minutes, so of course you won't be able to hear it all, but I can give you the site. It's on the C-SPAN, and you just look under police cameras, and you'll find it. It's in October. A date for the thing, but I think you'll find it interesting. One of the things, you know, just say right off, one of the things we want done in America is for all these police officers to wear body cameras. Let me see. The position of police officers is a position of honor and trust that's driven into your brain from the application process to the end of your career in most agencies around the United States. By the way, there are about 13,000 police agencies in the United States. Most people who've been commenting on this case don't even know that, that there are that many. And we have about over 500,000 people serving in law enforcement positions at most, by far, at the local level of government. And when you get into the federal agencies, they're very specialized agencies, the FBI, who knows how many different kind of things they handle, but the local police, whether it's a department of 14 or a department of several thousand in the United States in big cities, they do hundreds and hundreds of different types of responses. It's one of the most interesting jobs in the world, one of the most satisfying jobs. Police officers love it. Do they make mistakes sometimes? Do we sometimes hire the wrong person? Yes, but that's after about 12, 14, 15, 18 different steps, a minimum of 5 or 6 months, usually 6, 7 months of training, plus required in-service training during the year. And how do I know about this? Well, I did beat police officer work in a large city in the United States, and I also headed up the law enforcement system here in the state of Ohio, setting up all those training standards and helping with the qualifications to get hired and that type of thing. So, sounds like a little overstatement on my part. But anyway, I think you'll enjoy these people who have one thing in mind. I draw the conclusion they're not much interested in the police, and they're not that interested in protecting themselves against the police who run afoul, and that happens once in a while. And we can look at thousands of cases a year where the police are disciplined, lose their job, etc. But anyway, I think you'll enjoy this tonight, and then you can finish the rest of the video yourself on C-SPAN. Very interesting. Thank you very much, Audrey, Mike Sorrento, Lucy Spears, for getting us set on the show tonight. I got a lot of news to talk about, so I'll probably run over that like I usually do too quickly. But you can also find these things on the internet yourself. We all have the Google News brain, right? The Google brain. I don't know if you set up, you can still set up your own little newspaper on Google. I have mine with police, prisons, that type of thing, and it finds, on an hourly basis, all those kind of things. What we try to do in this show is discuss news issues, events, and new developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And we do dedicate the show to these energetic, tireless, dedicated, yes, police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals. We probably need to do some more on juvenile justice. That's a field that's kind of adrift right now. Much more popular in the 60s and 70s, but most people kind of forget we even got a juvenile justice system, but we do. All right, we want to thank Alan Levy and the CEO of BTR, the Law Talk Radio Network, for getting this thing going. And just remember that you, yes, you that are listening to me now, any person besides you, interest group or organization, can have their own show broadcasting live and streaming audio at no cost, worldwide, and to an unlimited number of listeners. And some of these shows that advertise and market and use all the social media, I don't do that. They have thousands and thousands of listeners. If you run through the Blog Talk Radio shows on blogtalkradio.com, you will see, you'll recognize names on their celebrities. And I just saw, Tavis Smiley on television last night. He's got a Blog Talk Radio show, I think, or at least he used to. Okay. Tonight's show, I already told you what we're going to be dealing with, and we want to start off with a blonde joke. We certainly wouldn't want to get going without a blonde joke, would we? I wouldn't. Let's see what this blonde joke is tonight. Yes. How's this? Two blondes were walking down the sidewalk. They were talking and they were having fun as usual. One blonde asked the other, "What would you be if you were not a blonde?" Her blonde friend looked directly at her and answered, she says, "For one thing, I would be intelligent." Isn't that awful? That's terrible that she would say that. For one thing, she'd be intelligent if she weren't blonde. Okay, you got to remember the Iowa Coalition Against Firearms. For years, they've been trying to get you to give up your guns. And I say you first. I wonder how many of the members of that coalition actually have guns to protect their home and have read up on the Castle Doctrine and all those kind of things. But let's listen to their message, and you pay attention to it and obey if you like.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
And by the way, they started that message long before Ohio permitted concealed carry. But I forget how many, Mike, how many states we now have? It's 2/3 of the states at least have concealed carry. It's more than that, actually. I think there's only like 10 or 12 states that don't do that now. So when you pull out a gun, when a group of people start to attack you, most of them are smart enough, even when they're not very smart, to run away. And that's why people carry a concealed handgun. Yes, you have to be careful, and there are some people who shouldn't do it. But anyway, here's a green tip right out of Esma Floyd's little book, 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. And this one is number 845. And her tip is this: don't buy a big car unless you need one. She says small is beautiful, and it's small is beautiful, and it's much less damaging to the environment. So that's green tip. So would you rather have a smaller car? I'm waiting to get my Helio. Have you seen the Helio? I've talked about that on the show. I mean, I think they come out in January, and they're what, 80 miles to the gallon. They'll go 700-800 miles on a tank of gas, and they go like 80, 90 miles an hour. The only thing is they're three wheels. They kind of look like an airplane. Well, a couple of you that are listening tonight actually go get one and drive it for a month or two and come on the show and let us know how it works. And then I'll go get mine, okay? Oh, well. But anyway, that's the kind of thing that that happens. All right. That was our green tip for tonight. Let's take a look at some of the news. That's always interesting. We always have news. And I got more than I can possibly carry tonight. I did have one here I was going to go over in some detail on the most dangerous cities in the United States. I'll just go over that real quickly. You probably might have seen that. I think it was USA Today news story, but you can get that on federal sites also. But you have to do some of the computation. But anyway, and ranking. Birmingham, Alabama is number 10. Milwaukee, Wisconsin is number 9. That kind of surprised me. Their violent crime is per 100,000 is 1364. Violent crimes in Birmingham is 1345. Rockford, Illinois is number 8. Yep. Baltimore, Maryland, not too surprising. I've been to Baltimore. Baltimore, Maryland is number 7. And what happened? Anyway, you get up there, Cleveland's number 5. Go look it up yourself. My information just got deleted. But it's a USA Today site. Just go to Google News and type in the most dangerous cities or just the web and you'll get that. I can't believe it. Where did it go, Mike? Oh, my gosh. It's gone. Have we been hacked? Must be the Chinese are coming after me. I'm kidding. Coming after me because I'm reading that book, At War, which I hope you read. It's about cyber warfare, the militarization of the or the rise of the military internet complex. Fascinating book. I have learned so much stuff. I can't put the book down. I can't find electronic copies on my iPad, but I can't find the hard copy. I've tried two bookstores and they don't have them. Okay, let's go down here a little bit farther and I'll give you a news story I wanted to do. Have you seen Sheriff David Clark from Milwaukee? In fact, he's going to be on the Fox News Channel again tonight, and he's thinking about running for public office. I got a picture of him here riding a horse, but it's Sheriff David A. Clark Jr., and he thinks Attorney General, by the way, the sheriff is African-American, he thinks Attorney General Eric Holder is guilty of race baiting in his tactics to Ferguson. In his response to the Ferguson situation. And he is a widely quoted and a tough-talking sheriff, and I can just tell you, a very intelligent man. Go look at some of the interviews now that are on YouTube with him, and he gets it, and he's back on tonight. I think he's on the Kelly file tonight, or maybe on Hannity or something, but you're going to hear more about this guy. I mean, he is really sharp, and he calls him Mike. He sees him. He happens to be a Democrat in Milwaukee, one of those dangerous cities. But anyway, you saw that Attorney General Holder, Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, a very famous church where Martin Luther King used to preach, he said that he will soon unveil a long-planned Justice Department guidance aimed at ending racial profiling. I wonder if he actually knows how much racial profiling goes on. He goes on and on and on about racial profiling. We've studied it time and time again in the United States, and we found some, but it was minuscule over the last 30 or 40 years. You know, cops don't join the police department, go through all that process. Yes, they experience danger. Keep in mind, they do law enforcement and catch crooks, but they also do service. You know, they deliver babies. They, you know, on and on and on. They do peacekeeping, you know, get out of the street. You're making too much noise with your loud radio, that type of thing. And they do service things. They help people. To me, that was one of the most enjoyable things about being a police officer, was helping people. You know, blind people standing on a corner actually waiting to get across the street. People do that, unfortunately. People that are elderly that can't get off across the street in time before the light changes. I've stopped traffic and helped them get across before. Many people have done all kinds of things like that and more. You know, made senior citizen centers turn up the heat when it was cold in there and people were freezing. I've done that one time. It's interesting that Eric Holder, federal agent, I wonder if Eric Holder's ever been in a police car. I said this last week. Do 3 8-hour shifts on a police car, and whatever your view is about the police, you'll learn more, and you may, in fact, change your decision, I mean your mind, about what police do and how they do it. It's not the most enjoyable job in the world in terms of people loving you, but most people, time and time again, we've proven it, respect the police and think they're doing a good job. That's in every kind of neighborhood that we have in the United States. What do we got here? I'm not going to talk about that. Yeah, I'm not going to talk about that. No, let's skip that one. That was about the president. I don't want to be. Anyway, you know what people are worried about now? I've talked about that, done whole shows on drones over the years. I actually owned one. I gave it away to my friend, and he gave it to his boy. But now anybody can buy a drone, and you're allowed to fly it. I think it's still, if you don't fly over 400 feet. And the price of drones have fallen, and sales have risen. The machines have emerged as central characters and stunts, from the puppish to the criminal. Drone pilots have tried to smuggle contraband into prisons. Can you imagine that? And then disrupt sporting events at athletic stadiums. Really weird. And rights groups are against, they've actually turned to drones. Yeah, that's right, to stalk hunters, because make sure that hunters are obeying the law. But anyway, look out. Look out your window tonight. If you see something out there that looks like a bird and it stays around, it might not. It might not be. anyway, that's interesting. Let me do one more news story. They did accuse the Cleveland police of using excessive force. Unreasonable force was a pattern of behavior that was in some cases endorsed by the supervisors. So now the federal government's going to require have the Cleveland police do certain things. Among the most troubling disclosures of this federal study of the Cleveland police was, in addition to fatal shootings, the excessive force involved victims who were struck in the head, sometimes with the butts of police-issued firearms. I wonder what the victims were doing. You know, both of these cases we're talking about tonight, and then I'll shut up about it, Ferguson and Staten Island, New York, terrible. Absolutely terrible. It breaks my heart that both of those gentlemen died. Both of those gentlemen died. They happened to be African-American. Both of them died. It's terrible. And the thing in New York just shouldn't have happened at all. But on the other hand, both of those gentlemen would be alive today if they'd have done what the police told them to do. Am I correct? I don't know how anyone could refute that. Both of them would be alive if they just did exactly what they said. And the gentleman selling the cigarettes, Lucy's, I didn't even know that term. How naive, right? But he was selling single cigarettes, and he had been arrested, I think, 13 times for other things. I don't know what they are. It doesn't make any difference. He shouldn't have died. And, you know, your best weapon in law enforcement is your ability to communicate and conversation. That's why we need to hire high IQ cops. A lot of police departments dropped their IQ test to get in. Some have dropped a written exam. Good old Dayton, Ohio, right down the road down here from me. Well, not right down the road. That's where I was a cop, and they had an entrance test. It was difficult, and they were going to drop it here about 5 or 6 years ago because the NAACP said, oh, no. People said that it was discriminatory toward African-Americans, and the NAACP came back and says, no, it isn't. We want to hire cops that are bright, no matter who they are. But I thought that was remarkable. This one I'm going to follow. In 3 weeks, Utah intends to seize control of 31.2 million acres of its own land, now under the control of the federal government. At least that's their plan. It's an unprecedented challenge to federal dominance of western state lands. Utah Governor Gary Herbert in 2012 signed the Transfer of Public Lands Act, which demands that Washington relinquish its hold on the land, which represents more than half of the state's 54.3 million acres. So we could have something really going on out there. And, you know, federal government, get out of our life, get off of our land. And that's going to be very interesting to watch. that's it. We're going to go right ahead to the presentation tonight. And I think you're going to enjoy this little video. Give me time to get it set up. It's on C-SPAN, so it takes a while to do. And the host will introduce the other guests. And when I hear this Marshall talk, I may not be able to control myself, but I'll shut up and let you listen. Here we go. And this is Police Body Cameras and Recording Misconduct. It's thinking. We're still trying.
Hello, welcome to the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm Kath Murthy. I'm the digital marketing manager here at Cato, and you are at our new media lunch, a regular series highlighting the intersection between tech, social media, and liberty. Our panelists here today will be discussing the policy and privacy concerns surrounding filming active duty police officers, as well as touching upon on-body camera programs and what those could potentially do to mitigate the problems of police misconduct. For those of you in our online audience and watching on C-SPAN today, our hashtag is NewMediaLunch, if you would like to tweet in questions. Otherwise, for those of you in the audience, we'll be taking them at the end of the panel. With no further ado, I'd like to introduce our first speaker here today, Steve Silverman. Steve is the founder and executive director of the Flex Your Rights organization, and he's also a Cato internship alum. He's the creator of the immensely popular educational movies, Busted, The Citizen's Guide to Surviving Police Encounters, and more recently, 10 Rules for Dealing with Police. In addition to self-distributing more than 35,000 DVDs, the Flex Your Rights YouTube channel has seen over 35 million views. Steve?
Thank you, Kat. I appreciate it. How many of you have seen the movie The Matrix? By show of hands. Okay, pretty much everybody. Good. So what I want to try to do is the same thing with you that happened to Neo. Do you remember when he said, I know Kung Fu, after they uploaded the Kung Fu program into his brain? Well, like I said, I want to try to do the same thing with you, but what I want is for you to say, I know how to record the police. So to do this, I've broken down this into Flex Your Rights, 5 rules for recording the police. Rule number 1, know the law. And the law is you have the right to openly record the police in public. You'll notice that I emphasized openly, and I'll explain why in a second. This first rule is probably the most important, but it's also the most confusing of the rules, because we've all seen videos where people are getting arrested for openly recording the police in public. And we see these, you know, every day, police intimidating people or even arresting people who do nothing more than film the police. And this is happening despite the fact that every state and federal circuit court to rule on this question has concluded that filming the police in public is First Amendment protected activity. But some of you might ask, well, what about the 12 or so states that have what are called all-party consent laws that require all parties to agree to be recorded? Well, we have good news here, because the courts in these states have ruled that those laws do not apply to citizens who are openly recording the police in public. So the most obvious and effective way to avoid running afoul of these all-party consent laws is to use your camera like you are a reporter, not like you're a spy. So you want to be always openly recording. Some of you who know a little bit about these laws might be saying, well, wait a second. What about Massachusetts and Illinois? These are two states that have statutes on their books that make it illegal to record the police in public. Again, there's good news here, because in 2011, the First Circuit Court of Appeals covering Massachusetts declared their law to be unconstitutional. Soon afterwards, in 2012, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals covering Illinois did the exact same thing. So those laws have been invalidated. Therefore, in the United States, citizens always have the right to openly record the police in public. So if you're recording the police and police tell you to put your camera away, that is an unlawful order. And so in this situation, I would argue that it is okay to inform the police of your law by saying something like, officer, I'm familiar with the law, but the courts have ruled that it doesn't apply to recording on-duty police. I generally don't advise in favor of educating the police about the law in other sorts of encounters. They generally do not appreciate that. But in this situation, I think it is advisable. Rule number two, know your technology. How many of you have a smartphone on you right now by a show of smartphones? I think that's pretty much most everybody here, and that is great. Now, how many of you who have a smartphone passcode protect your phone? Or actually, most of you, who of you by here does not passcode protect your phone? You shouldn't admit to that. No, it's okay. But you can easily secure it by installing a passcode protection. I highly recommend it. The Supreme Court recently passed a very excellent ruling requiring police to obtain a warrant before searching your smartphone. But in the meantime, it's always a good idea to keep it locked down because sometimes police don't get the memo right away. Now, how many of you have a streaming video recording app on the home screen of your smartphone? Really? We got like 3, 4, 5? That's fantastic. Now, for those of you who don't have this, I'm going to show you right now the benefits of keeping a streaming video app on your home screen. Right now, I'm unlocking my secret passcode. I'm tapping the Bamboozer streaming video recording app. I don't work for Bamboozer, but right now they have the best streaming video recording app out there, and I'm now streaming you all live to an offsite server. Now, the benefit of this for when you are recording the police is that if a police officer unlawfully tries to snatch, confiscate, or destroy your smartphone, what you have recorded up until that moment will be saved securely offsite. Also, if you use Bamboozer or another live streaming video recording app, Bamboozer in particular has a neat feature where if you tap the sleep button, what happens is your screen goes blank, and this can be an additional security and protection for your data, because the passcode, it goes to sleep, but if they try to unlock it, if they turn it on, they're going to get a passcode. And, of course, you're not going to give them your passcode, and they're not going to be able to get into and delete your recordings, which is an extra layer of protection. Rule number three, respond to things cops say. C-SPAN is here, so I'll just keep it as things cops say. For example, cops might say, if you are, for example, recording an arrest that's happening, you're a witness, suddenly you might see a situation where one of the police officers will break off from that and will suddenly approach you and say, hey, buddy, what are you doing? Well, sometimes people make the mistake of responding with something like, officer, I'm recording you to make sure you're doing your job right. Or I'm recording you because I don't trust the police. There's a better way to say this. I think a better way to approach this less confrontationally is to say something like, officer, I'm not interfering. I'm asserting my First Amendment right to record. You're being documented and recorded off-site. That's why it's a good idea to use a live streaming video recorder. Another thing that cops might say is, hey, please stop recording me. That is against the law. And police who are in those 12 states with all party consent laws might actually use this misunderstanding of the law in order to try to get you to stop recording. And in this situation, again, okay to say something like, officer, I'm familiar with the law, but the courts have ruled that the law doesn't apply to recording on-duty police. Another thing, officers might scream at you and say, hey, stand back, get back, you're interfering, I need you to step back. A good response to this is to step back. I think it's okay to be a little bit flexible in this situation. Say something like, officer, I'm not interfering, I'm asserting my First Amendment right to record. It's for my safety and for yours. Rule number 4, do not point your camera at the police like it's a gun, like this. I've seen lots of videos where people kind of get aggressive and they shove it in their face like this. I don't think it's a really good idea. I think a better way to do it, and also you can avoid that vertical video syndrome that you might see in some videos that people post online where you see the black borders and it's really ugly and it looks like you're looking at the video through like a crack in the door. Make sure you go horizontal. And I think it's a good idea to record like this. When you hold the phone at waist level, I think it's a lot less confrontational pose, and you can still look at the screen and get a perfectly good shot. You don't have to frame it up like a cinematographer. It's okay if you clip the officer's head in the process, but it's better than pointing your camera like a gun, and you can avoid that vertical video. Rule number 5, final rule, prepare to be arrested. I've been telling you the whole time basically how this is perfectly legal behavior, and yet if you are brave enough to record the police, you must look at this activity as a potential act of civil disobedience that can lead to your arrest. Now, it's troubling that citizens who are not breaking the law should prepare to be arrested, but if the officer says, shut it off or I will arrest you, you should take the officer at his or her word. At this point, it's entirely up to you if you want to continue testing the boundaries of free speech and risk arrest. You may comply by saying something like, officer, okay, I'm turning the camera off, but under protest. Or, if you keep recording, brace yourself for arrest. If you're recording with Bamboozer, for example, hit the sleep button to prevent police from deleting your footage that is now stored off-site. Do not physically resist. And as with any arrest, you have the right to remain silent until you speak with a lawyer. You should use this right by shutting up. Keep calm and be confident that any frivolous charges against you will almost certainly be dropped, and you will have preserved video evidence of an illegal arrest that might become the basis of a potentially lucrative lawsuit. But more importantly than that, your brave stand can help change the way police treat other citizens who assert the First Amendment right to record police. So congratulations, you've all been upgraded. You now know how to record the police.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Our next presenter here today is Jonathan Blank. Jonathan is a research associate in Cato Center for Constitutional Studies, and he's also a blog editor with Cato at Liberty, Cato's online blog. His research interests include police misconduct, the drug war, over-criminalization, and other criminal justice issues. His work has been published in online outlets like Rare.us and Reason.com, as well as print and online editions of the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, and Denver Post. He also maintains a personal blog, Blank Space, Blank Slate, and you can follow him on Twitter at Blank Slate.
Thank you, Kat. First of all, I want to apologize for Tim Lynch. He was originally scheduled to be here, but he's fell ill, but I'm so happy to be here instead because this is something I'm very passionate about. PoliceMisconduct.net is a KU resource that we use to disseminate the many instances of police abuse and crime throughout the country. I should also take this moment to thank Katie Ranville, who does so much work behind the scenes of keeping this site up and running and up to date. The website is not meant to shame police as a whole or be anti-cop in any real way. We believe that police officers are trying to do their best, but that the incentives and institutional pressures for rule-breaking are existent, and that this too often leads to rights violations against both the guilty and the innocent. We show how often this occurs with daily roundups of the latest news around the country of police breaking the laws. Police misconduct tends to be thought of as a sort of rare, like bad apple sort of incident where it's just one cop and it's not representative of the entire department. And that's often very true. You know, it only does take one cop to give the rest of the cops a bad example. However, there are many factors that shield and protect bad cops, including the complicity of good cops who, though they may resent the bad ones, feel through police solidarity that they need to stay quiet or support him. But that's kind of a long story for Q&A or some other time. But because of this reputational imbalance between police and an accused defendant, misconduct often goes unnoticed or unreported. Moreover, when officers are caught doing bad things, such incidents are often dismissed out of hand again as the sort of bad apples situation. But we feel that police misconduct is something that requires more attention because, as Justice Brandeis said, sunlight is the best disinfectant. If the more we know about police misconduct, the better we know how to deal with bad apples and the better that we can stop bad management of police agencies. And technology is a growing part of maintaining that accountability from both an internal police perspective and from forced accountability by the citizens, as Steve described. There is reason to be optimistic about the future of policing due to the advances in recording technology. As Steve explained, most all of us have cell phones with recording technology, and they're virtually ubiquitous. Likewise, dash cams have been standard in patrol cars for a very long time, and now the technology allows police officers to wear cameras on their person, so they can now record every instance that they come into contact with the public. These technologies, of course, allow for neutral observers to observe contested events and stops after the fact. And so this sometimes, obviously, police can be shown to have abused their authority, and this can exonerate an innocent person. But it also works to protect the police. Just recently, an officer was accused of sexual assault from someone that he stopped, and his camera showed that he did absolutely nothing wrong, and it exonerated him. Because affordable and accessible technology may have finally brought us closer to finally answering the question, who watches the watchers? We all do. As many of you probably know, the official autopsy results of the Michael Brown case in Ferguson, Missouri, released yesterday along with leaked grand jury evidence. If Officer Wilson was wearing a body camera, perhaps we'd have a better idea of what actually transpired between his instruction for Brown and his friend to leave the street and the altercation that eventually led to Michael Brown's death. I say perhaps because we know technology is only as good as the people who use it and share it. Cameras are not a cure-all. There are instances caught on film in which police are clearly violating the rights of others, but they escape prosecution, punishment, or conviction. 2 years ago, there was a young man in Prince George's County, Maryland, just outside of D.C., who was assaulted by a police officer. The man's crime was essentially walking away from a police officer who wanted his attention. The police officer started running after him, and he turns around hearing the running footsteps of the cop. The police officer is not yelling, "Stop, police," or anything. He turns around to see who's running after him, and he gets hit in the face with a gun. The gun goes off. Luckily, no one is shot, but this man, again, was assaulted by a police officer. Luckily, there was surveillance footage of this because the man was charged and spent a month in jail for essentially being physically assaulted by a police officer. Now, the police officer was charged. He could go to trial, what he wants. There's video evidence, and it didn't get him off. He also was not fired from the police department. He had back issues, and he was allowed to retire, which usually means a pension. And likewise, as Radley Balco has noted, video evidence sometimes withheld from by police departments. One instance that he noted was a woman was pulled over by the police, and she claims that she was injured during that stop. Backup police came. There were 7 dash cams. All mysteriously, simultaneously stopped working. And so it was her word against 7 police officers. Guess what happened? People's word against the police in court are usually not good without video evidence. And part of this is because people want to believe police officers, and I understand that impulse, but they are people just like the rest of us. People lie, and they have many incentives to lie. And this is where the public comes in. As Steve was saying, that if you follow the right rules, if you follow his rules, you can get tape evidence of misconduct in your own neighborhoods. But I must caution that this still is a dangerous endeavor. I think some of you probably saw during the protest in Ferguson, there was a large sort of moving protest, and a police officer was in the middle of it, frightened and scared, and he pointed his assault weapon at individuals, and he threatened to kill one of them. And this was caught on tape, and the videographer asked him, you know, like, did you just threaten to kill me? What's your name? The officer responded with something I'm not going to say on C-SPAN, but that became his nickname and became, you know, it went viral. Because of that video, that officer was found, he was identified, and he was fired. That is very rare. If that police officer got too scared or someone bumped into him or something went wrong, that person with the video camera could have been shot. So please be very careful. I'm not saying don't do it. Please do. But just understand the risks and be as careful as you possibly can. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Jonathan. And then our final panelist here today is Matthew Fogg. Matthew is a retired chief deputy of the U.S. Federal Marshal Service and a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He received the District of Columbia U.S. Attorney and Federal Bar Association's highest law enforcement awards for tracking down over 300 of America's most wanted and dangerous fugitives. And after 32 years of service, Matthew retired following a final D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals decision, finding USMS grossly violated his civil rights and was operating a racially hostile environment for African-American deputy U.S. Marshals nationwide. Matthew holds leadership positions in 3 nonprofit government watchdog organizations today. You can find him on Twitter at USMarshal77. Matthew?
Thank you very much. It's good to be here, and thanks for the introduction, Kat. And I agree wholeheartedly with my two colleagues, Steve and Jonathan, things that have been presented here. But I present a law enforcement perspective that also, just to augment and add to that, some of the things that I've observed. And one of the things, as you heard when you said, that for me to win a lawsuit even against the Justice Department says that there were improprieties, a lot of things going on wrong on the inside. The one thing I always remember when I came out of the academy and I arrived at my duty station here in Washington, D.C., I remember the manager telling me, says, Fogg, look, because I was this young recruit, all excited, had all of this training, point, shoot, when to shoot, how to use the First and Fourth Amendment rights, how what your rights were, and how to implement the law, so to speak, and was really excited about it. First thing he said to me was, Fogg, I know you guys learned all that stuff at the academy and all that. He says, listen, but this is how we do it here. And I always remember him saying that to you. This is how we do it here. And what I'm going to say to you about this is when we look at the body cameras and we say what types of solutions we can come up with to help us to maybe understand police better and maybe get a better understanding of the situation. We have to understand, when I'm on that street as a law enforcement officer, I have a lot of discretion, and I have a network behind me that's going to back me up. Sometimes we call it the good old boy network, whatever you want to call it, but it includes police officers, includes prosecutors, includes judges. It's a whole network, and even those when we used to grand jury, I remember when I sat on the grand jury, and I remember that close relationship that the U.S. attorneys had with the grand jurors, talking to them every day, communicating, laughing, joking together, coming together. So that right there had a major influence on those cases that they even brought before the grand jury, whether they're going to get indictments in that. What I'm saying to you is there's a network here that we're talking about. How do we build and how do we get into that network? Now, being a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP is a powerful organization because we nationally, across the whole country, we send a message out. The war on drugs is bad policy. But not only is it bad policy, not only is it across the country a lot of money, it's probably one of the most racist policies that has been instituted since slavery. And that's pretty powerful. But when you begin to look at the disparities in the numbers from the ACLU report, I was a member of Amnesty International. We did a racial profiling report that indicated more people have been profiled since 9/11 than the population of Canada. I mean, I've seen so many reports that show the disparities aren't close. They're so widespread. Then we look and we see what happened in Ferguson, when we see what happened in New York, the chokehold. We're seeing this stuff now right on television. We saw this man be choked to death while he was saying, "I can't breathe," and he was ultimately killed. We saw Rodney King get beat, hit how many times with a stick, watching this right on television. Everybody's saying, "That is awful, that is crazy." But what happens? The officers don't get convicted. Because what happens is that network behind you says, "This is how we do it here." So what I'm trying to say is this. Yes, body cameras are good, but it really, we don't know, to be honest with you, when all that information has gone back, and when you're sitting in front of a jury, and that officer is allowed to go back and rethink everything, because as you know, the law is different when officers involved. They don't have to give a statement right away. All the protections that they have, and once they get back, people are telling them, "I know, I've been involved in this shooting. I know what they say. Look, you want to change this. You don't want to say this. You want to be careful how you put this forward." All of this is real, ladies and gentlemen. And what I'm saying to you is once that begins to happen, you take a year or 2 years for a trial to come up, that jury is sitting there and that jury is hearing the officer saying, "Oh, well, I believe I thought he had a gun and I was threat for my life, and I remember one of my partners was killed 6 months ago, or so-and-so was killed, so I felt a threat when he turned around and he looked at me with his hands up saying, 'Don't shoot.' I still felt a threat." And you're going to get people that are going to sit on that jury and going to listen and say, "You know what, I wasn't out there, and I know police officers have a lot that they got to go through every day, and so therefore I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt." What I'm simply saying here is there is a lot in law enforcement that is wrong, but we need protection. I dare say to you this, when I won my case, everybody said to me first, "Fog, don't take on the Justice Department. Don't go forward. You know what happens to cops when they blow the whistle and they speak out. Your career will be destroyed, and not only that, but they will probably kill you or set you up in a stake." And believe it or not, that happened. My backup actually left me in a stakeout. My black partner, who also raised a discrimination complaint about the internal impropriety, wound up dead. Somebody ran his car off the road. They don't know who killed Bill Scott to this day. The white marshal that spoke up, he lost his job. He went to Congress and testified how they gave him a black rubber rat. He's holding that up before Congress. That's what they gave him in the squad bay. So what I'm saying to you is, we've got these situations out here that we're looking at that are going on in Ferguson and down in Sanford, Florida, and mainly because, like I said, now it is an issue with the cameras and so forth. But this stuff has been going on, ladies and gentlemen, forever. It has been out there. Trust me, with my 32 years of law enforcement, I saw a lot of questionable incidents that I had to tell officers right then and there, "You're not going to do that in front of me right here." When I'm working with other departments, because see, as U.S. Marshals, I would work for Seattle, Miami, LAPD, New York PD. And I'm going to tell you, I saw some of the most egregious violations of your rights. And let me tell you something. You pull a vehicle over, and a young man says to him, tell that officer, "Do I have some rights here?" Or, "No, you can't search my car." Then he'll just bring a dog, and the dog's nickname is Alert. That's his nickname.
He will be a riser. What I'm saying to you is there are all kinds of ways to get around your First and your Fourth Amendment rights, if that's what I want to do. And see, most African-Americans out there in the street, they know that, so they don't even want to challenge it a lot of times. Because if you get pulled over, you on your way to work or you on your way to going somewhere, you know right there that officer can put you in a situation where he can either create a problem for you, so you just give him consent. You don't want to be held up for work. You don't want to go through these changes. So you give them the consent, and you say, go ahead. Now, it's easy to stand back and say, no, I don't want you to search my vehicle or all of the other rights that you have. But there are so many other things that come into play out here on that street. And what I'm saying is until we start to address those issues, until we start to really say to people, why are these disparities when we look at the same drug, crack cocaine, arrest, and we look at the same arrest, the same incident, but we see the numbers of,
I'm going to have to comment. The marshal, retired Matthew Fogg, needs to read some academic journals. He's mentioned none. We've been studying the issues he's talked about for 40 to 50 years. Most of them show up that this discrimination and racial profiling does not exist. It's in people's minds. And when the people figure out what the police actually knew when they stopped, and then they say, oh, I was stopped for a reason. I could go on, but I won't. We'll listen to more of his presentation now.
Of African Americans that are arrested, charged, and doing time for the same drug. I've always said, if the war on drugs was an equal opportunity enforcement operation, we wouldn't even be having the war on drugs issue today, because it would have been over the same way as alcohol prohibition. But because it's not equal, like that manager told me when I was working with DEA, he said to me, I said, look, we got all of our drug and gun interdiction task forces in all the urban areas. Miami, Seattle, Washington, but they were all urban areas we were focusing on. I said, don't they use drugs in Potomac, Maryland? Don't they use them in Silver Spring or other maybe more affluent locations? He said, yes, Paul. Matter of fact, they use them probably more. They got the better stuff. He says, but if we go out there and start to lock those folks up, throw flashbangs in their homes, run through their houses, do all of the things that we do in our enforcement operations, you know what happens? We will get a phone call, and it will shut our operation down. And there goes your overtime. There goes all your excitement, all your money, and everything you make it. So you know what he said? They're still using the drugs. Let's just go to the weakest link and get our numbers up. And I told him that's ethnic cleansing. But this is what we have to look at. We have to understand this whole process and how it's working. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. So from what all of the panelists, all of you guys were saying here today, it sort of sounds as if cameras would be a part of a solution. Are they actually a viable solution for police misconduct? Do they need to be part of an overall strategy? Are they maybe not going to work?
I think that certainly, as Matt kind of pointed out so well, you can't count on cameras to cure the problem. But I think, you know, what video does is it brings us closer to the truth, and the truth can bring us closer to justice and accountability. I think that I like the fact that you have politicians like Rand Paul and Claire McCaskill in the wake of Ferguson are now talking about funding for cameras, body cameras for the police, because I think what we've seen in sort of small trials that have been done where I think it was Rialto, California. It was a trial that was funded, I think, by like Taser Incorporated. And so you sort of have to take it with a grain of salt, I think. But they, in that small study, they found after a year the incidence of police actually using force reduced by about 80%, really striking reduction. And the incident of police misconduct reports was reduced by about 60%. So I think what you're seeing is just what I hope to see more often is the police officer with the body camera facing off against the citizen carrying a camera. And what you're going to have there is a very...
The body camera not only keeps the police officer from using force, but if a person knows they're being photographed or videotaped, they won't use force against the police officer, correct?
Pleasant and lawful police encounter, I think, more times than not. And that's a good thing, because video brings us the truth, which brings us closer to justice. I agree with pretty much everything. Well, not pretty much. I agree with everything Steve said. There are cultural problems within police departments. The thing called the thin blue line, where cops will not testify against each other for the reason that Matt said, it's really, when you read the stories, I mean, you think of it, when you think of corruption, you think, okay, well, you know, his wife left him. He's really taking a little bit of money on the side. It's not that big a deal. You know, no one's dying. But the problem is...
There's about 40 to 50 minutes left on this one. You can find it on C-SPAN.org, and it's called Police Body Cameras and Recording Misconduct. And the date for it was October 23rd, 2014, so not very old, couple months old. That's going to do it for tonight. I hope you enjoyed some of the issues brought forth in this particular presentation. It raises all kinds of things, and we need to think about them. We'll do that, and we'll ask Vera Lynn to sign us off, and we'll see you next week. She'll be singing, by the way. We'll meet again.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was